welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are joined this week by a wonderful, wonderful guest, Alicia from the Lorehounds. Alicia, how are you doing?
Great. Glad to be here. Glad to talk about Dune. I rewatched the whole movie last night, not just these 5 minutes. So that was really fun to do. It's amazing how much there is in that film.
Yeah, I guess it's like a, once you watch a little bit of it, you kind of have to watch the whole thing. Especially if you're not like for me, when I was over at a friend's house the other week and they offered to put on Dune and I said, please no, I'm going through this minute by minute. Yeah, quite literally anything else.
I'm going through this minute by minute and I'm going to talk about everything that I've already talked about and I'm going to be insufferable.
But if you have, especially if you haven't watched it in a while, just getting a 5 minute snippet of the movie probably makes you want to watch the rest of it.
Yeah, I've also been recently rereading the book for We'll Shift Dust, and I gave this for the first time. I gave the movie a 4.5 instead of a 5 stars out of 5 because when you watch it too close to when you're reading the book, you just start to get a little irked by the differences, even though there are other ways that I think the movie drastically improved on the book, and we'll get to talk about at least one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty much reading the book concurrently with watching the movie as we do these minutes, so I noticed that a lot.
Mm-hmm. We're reading the book concurrently and the encyclopedia concurrently.
Oh, you and your encyclopedia. And
we love it. It's great. Yeah. it definitely makes for a very interesting, like, multifaceted approach to understanding Dune. And clearly we love doing it because we're 206 episodes or something in.
Wow. Something
like it's that. Yeah, we've been doing this for a little bit, so
cool. Well, let's dive into this this week. This is going to be a thick week of episodes, because we got a lot to talk about, a lot of lore heavy stuff that we're going to get to see, a lot of action.
Mm-hmm.
And some really cool seed pods on backs of worms. So let's go ahead and kick it off. We are, of course, talking about minute 60 through 61 of Dune Part 2. And we pick right back up with Paul and Chani whispering sweet nothings to each other in bed. just normal stuff like they worship you, and the Fedaiken, they count your victories.
Standard post-coital conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do have to say, I think when I was talking about things that the movie improves upon, I think that Chani is less subservient than she is in the book. She's less like, oh, my great lord, Mawadib Uso.
She is, for sure. I think that pendulum kind of swung pretty far in that direction of as far as like changes to her character, because she's not that we don't get that real like the religiosity aspect of her character at all from the books.
No, but I like this distinction that they make between the northerners and the southerners, who are more isolated and more religious, more fanatical. But yeah, I like that she is the one pushing back on Paul. It makes sense that he would be drawn to that. And I think also Irulan gets a big glow up in this film, because she's only like there to give quotes at the beginning of each chapter for most of the first book. So I'm glad that they showed her just what a pawn she is in this, and a willing pawn at that. But that doesn't mean it's any less scary. Yeah. So anyway, I like... as much as I was talking about quibbles versus the book, I like the fact that they have developed these two women more.
Yeah, agreed. So Chani continues. She says, they say you can see the future. They whisper Lisan al-Ghaib. And that's when Paul responds with, I'm no messiah. I'm a Fedaiken of Siege Tabr. And I can never say that word right, so I'm not even going to try. Siege Tabir, Tabra.
Tabr.
Tabr.
Tabr. checking with another friend of the show, Kaf, it is Tabr.
So. Tabr, okay, cool.
At least as far as like as close to an Arabic pronunciation as you would have for the BR thing. So
gotcha.
But yeah, name dropping part 3 already. because maybe he is a messiah, who knows. But yeah, Paul's still very, you know, reluctant to the whole, you know, missionary protectiva Lisa and Al-Ghaib story. He doesn't necessarily want that. We still haven't, you know, fully dove into that character arc just yet in the movie, which we're gonna kind of get to a little bit of a boiling point with that later on this week.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm usually one who gets annoyed when characters refuse the call to adventure too frequently.
Sure.
But in this case, I feel like it's almost also to get in front of the white savior debates. Like, no, he recognizes that they should. Well, I guess we'll talk about that in a future minute. But
this is the hard part of the minute by minute format is like you want to talk about all these other things that are gonna happen in just a couple minutes, but you gotta wait until that episode.
Yeah.
When we were talking with David, one of the things that he was saying was just how difficult it is to like try and compartmentalize all the things you want to say, but it hasn't happened yet. So I'm sure this has been a fun little challenge for you as well.
There's good chemistry though between them. I don't think John agrees with me. He's not a Zendaya fan, nor am I per se, but I think these two have good chemistry in this film.
I wouldn't say I'm not a Zendaya fan. I very much like what they did with, you know, choosing her for this role. I think she fits the role really well, especially with the more defiant Chani that was written rather than the more subservient mm-hmm. Chani that we have in the books and, you know, in other adaptations. Like if you go back and watch the Lynch film, she is very subservient and very, you know, religiously minded and everything. So it's a fresh new take, and I think she was the right actress for that role.
I agree.
But yeah, like Zach said, Paul says, "I am no messiah. I'm a Fadaikin of Siege Tabor." And Chani's quick-witted response talking about, you know, her not being so religiously minded in this movie is, "Yet we have a Bene Gesserit among us fanning the flames of your legend, saying you're the one." So she's very clearly and very obviously pointing out to Paul, like, hey, your mom is really, like, fucking up this whole you don't want to be the messiah thing for you.
She's not so a Jessica fan.
Maybe go handle that. Yeah. And Paul kind of realizes, too, because his immediate response is the same exasperated sigh I think all of us have when someone points out some bullshit that we weren't exactly expecting them to hit us with. And he just kind of leans back and into his pillow and just goes, oh, fine, I guess.
Yeah, it's an interesting relationship between the two women. Yeah, and now I'm trying not to talk about the end of the movie anymore. But
yeah, we will for sure get to explore that a lot more later.
Yeah.
So from here, we smash cut, or rather, maybe a better word is a thumper cut to the desert.
A thump cut?
Yeah. We get a thumper doing its thing, and a large group of Fremen kind of walking down the hill into this little low point in the desert between some dunes. There's one Fremen crouched off in the distance watching, maybe for worms. I'm assuming for worms.
Yeah.
And we see a bunch of like large objects towards the front of this line that they've been set on the ground. And then we finally get to see Jessica again. We haven't seen her for a while. The camera kind of cuts back around to Paul and Jessica.
We saw her a couple minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. It's been a while for you guys.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, gosh. That was weeks ago in real life.
Yeah. But yeah, we saw her a couple minutes ago when, you know, she was informed of Paul's writing.
You are correct. Shai-Hulud.
Yeah. But this is the first time on screen that Paul and Jessica have been together since Jessica took the Water of Life.
Right.
Well, since right after.
Yeah.
The Beauty and the Horror, all of that speech, which I have some things to talk about with that later on this week as well.
Hmm. Okay, we'll get to it. This is a strange conversation that we're about to get into.
Wait, I have a question about thumpers, though, first. Are these one-time uses? Like, how many do they go through, and where do they get all the parts?
So I've always assumed that the worm eats the thumper.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So that's why I assume one-time use. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in the books, we get the Seatras are a lot more expanded upon. We get to see a lot more of like the inner workings of the Seach. And if I'm remembering correctly, they have like factories and all sorts of stuff like where they manufacture the still suits and the thumpers and all these other gadgets that the Fremen use.
Yeah. I guess still suits. Yeah.
I don't know where they would get the raw materials.
Exactly. Yeah. The metal and stuff. Yeah. But anyway, sorry.
Maybe there's a smelting factory where they take old Harkonnens and harvesters that they blow up and they take all the metals from there and they smelt it down.
That makes sense.
It would also stand to reason that if they're digging Seaches deeper and deeper to expand them, that maybe they're coming across like iron or whatever as well. I mean, the books and the encyclopedia don't really go too hard into
what's under the surface, the
material sciences of what is and isn't available.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yet at the same time, it also does talk about how they manufacture a lot of plastics for like the tubing and stuff like that in still suits. So
I would assume the Fremen would be a little more eco-friendly than large manufacturers of plastics.
Yeah, I don't know.
If they keep using the plastic forever, which I assume they will.
Yeah, fair. Microplastics are a large problem on Arrakis. It's not really talked about much. So, like I was saying, this conversation that we're about to get into is really strange because it is technically a conversation between two people, but there's a third party that is really doing most of the talking.
It's a conversation between three people. Let's three be people. Real. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe a person in like an interpreter, I guess. John, I don't know if you remember back to your customer service answering phone call days, and if you ever got a phone call from a ASL or sign language interpreter. Did you ever get one of those?
No, but I know that when you get those calls, it like blares out, hey, someone's interpreting at the start of this call.
So basically what the structure of this is like, if you need to have a sign language interpreter, you will use this service. They will speak to you or have, or you will be signing to them. They will interpret your words to whoever you need to speak to over the phone. So that's the situation pretty much that I felt like we were in right now. with Paul speaking to who we know is Alia. I don't think we've gotten a name mentioned just yet, but
Alia hasn't been named. Okay.
Are we calling her Alia or Aaliyah? Because for some reason I have Aaliyah in my head.
In my head, it's always been Alia, but I know that there's the Alia versus Aaliyah, and I know that Dune Navigator Martin is listening to this right now, and it's giving him more fuel for his synod of Dune pronunciations. So
we have a long history of pronouncing things differently on the show.
Zach says Rabban, I say Rabban.
Hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the earlier movies said Alia, and that's what I've always kind of just like latched onto.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like they changed from Harkonnen, from Harkonnen to Harkonnen because they're like, oh wait, let's actually pronounce it more like the Finnish name. Yeah,
they changed from Landsdrad to Landsrad.
Well, that was just because couldn't pronounce anything Dutch right.
Word. Yeah,
yeah, that's a Dutch word, Landsrad.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys asked me to listen to a couple specific episodes for a theory regarding the communication. Is the theory you had that, I'm going to call her Aaliyah, that's what I call her in my head.
Yeah, that's fine.
it's a theory that Aaliyah is controlling Jessica? Was that the theory that I was picking up? Or
at times, yes. So I don't think that applies right here. I think Jessica is truly just sensing like a conversation and passing it along. But there are times where we feel like Alia is literally speaking through Jessica as more of in control of her body kind of man.
Specifically in moments of religious fervor. That's the like big, at least from what we've been able to gather, that's like the big differentiator in terms of who is speaking. And it kind of makes sense for Alia to want to be a bit more fanatical than Jessica, because Alia wants Paul to, you know, truly become the Kwisatz Haderach, and to like, not saying that Jessica doesn't, because the whole point of her having Paul was to make a Kwisatz Haderach, but I feel like Alia, by nature of being pre-born and having all of her mother's memories from before Paul was born and everything, kind of took that and then just really ran with it and went a million miles a minute in terms of like amping up the fanaticism that she has for Paul. Because every time that Jessica in the movie has talked about Alia, it's always, she believes in you. She wants you to, you know, become the Kwisatz Haderach and to like really go forward. So there's a couple moments with the whole thing that I was talking about earlier this episode with the beauty and the horror scene, that conversation that Paul and Jessica have, where it almost seems like the line Kwisatz Haderach, show us the way, which was spoken in Chikopsa, was more Alia speaking rather than Jessica. At least that was my reading and understanding of it. And then there was the scene earlier on where Jessica had recovered from drinking the water of life, but Paul was away with the Fedaiken, and she's talking to Alia about how they must, you know, really subjugate all of the Fremen in the north before they even consider going south, and really like drive them toward this religious fanaticism before they leave and continue on with their proselytizing, shall we say.
Yeah, I agree that Alia is the zealot of the group there, and that, you know, she's influencing her mother probably pretty directly in that regard also. Although I don't know that I think it's a control thing. There's this podcast fiction story that I really enjoy called Give Me Away. And it's about, okay, so this, without getting into it too much, there's a spaceship that crash lands on Earth, and they discover that there's these psyches from another planet trapped inside, and they're being tortured. And the only way for them to get out of this situation is for humans to agree to download one into their body. So then you have two psyches sharing a body. And so... I think, Zach, you were just saying this, that it's like the interpreter sort of thing, where the person whose body it is responsible for speaking on both behalves, and not like has to be trained, like, don't silence the person inside, even if you don't agree with them. And yeah,
right.
I feel like that's the situation here.
Yeah, I can see how that fits. Yeah.
I also noticed that this is later, but Jessica does tell her no about something later. Not in our minutes.
I think there's distinct moments of like, yes, they can converse like back and forth with each other. But there are other times where I feel like it's not the personality of Jessica that we've come to know, like that we see. It's a different, much more radical personality. So that's what kind of leads me to think that, okay, maybe Alia is taking over more than just speaking through her. She's influencing more of that psyche. I don't know, though, just a theory. Who knows?
I mean, but it's like, if you have a best friend who thinks a certain way, they can easily influence you, but just by talking about it. Now imagine that they live inside you and are literally connected to your nervous system.
They live inside you and you can't escape them. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that this is a definitive, like, absolutely Alia's taking control kind of thing. It's just when we've been watching these movies minute by minute and going over things, you do find some very small, subtle details that maybe are intended and maybe are not. And it's been a pretty cool way of kind of looking at and analyzing the movie. I mean, I don't ever expect to be able to speak to any of the writers, but I would love to, you know, just kind of run the idea past them and just be like, hey, was this an intentional thing, or am I just crazy and reading way too much into it? And they're probably going to say, you're insane. Why are you talking to me?
How did you get my number?
Yeah. Go away. I'm trying to have dinner.
The first words we get out of this conversation is Jessica just kind of like looking down, and she just goes, And she's got her Reverend Mother headdress on, and all the cloth coverings, and a Fremen off in the distance as she says, shouts, Reverend Mother, I cannot pronounce this word.
Palanquin.
Palanquin, thank you.
Palanquin.
That's what I was going with, yeah. Palanquin. Your palanquin is ready. John, what is that?
It's so you know how whenever you watch any kind of medieval themed movie, there's always like a member of royalty being carried in the box throughout the town. That's what a palanquin is.
Okay. Well, we've definitely seen them before.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. Think back to, you know, House of the Dragon or Game of Thrones, you know, whenever any of the members of the royal family are being moved in that box.
Okay.
So Jessica's queen of the Fremen, kind of.
I think she, yeah, almost. Oh, this one is going to be attached to a worm. So that's a heck of a palanquin bearer that they got here.
And I've got some notes on the palanquin, but we're gonna you're gonna have to hold off.
Okay, we'll hold off for on
later on in the week. Art and Soul's got some things to say.
Good deal. So Jessica continues the conversation, and she says you should be coming with us. And Paul looks and he says, you know, I can't. And there's definitely some tension here between them. Because like you said, this is the first time that they've really been together since shortly after the Water of Life ceremony. Mm-hmm. Paul's done a lot. He has done a whole heck of a lot since then. So has Jessica. We just didn't get to see that on screen. I felt there was tension between the two of them right here.
Yeah.
Or three of them, I should say. Jessica continues and says she's asking why. And Paul responds with, because I must continue fighting in the north to protect you down there in the south.
No, they said down there, and that's, and then it cuts off. I wonder, I mean, this whole, you know, I was thinking about, it's such a job to pare down this book into two films in this case.
Yeah.
And so I've been like, I'm very forgiving of the fact, for instance, that, Hawat was cut out of this, you know, there's not really talk about the Mentats or all these other elements. But I wonder, like, could they have simplified him constantly saying no? How many times does he say no? Is this a significant number of times? Could they have pared that down a little bit so that they could fit in more other things? That's what I was wondering last night as I was watching.
Probably. Yes. This, I don't know. What do you think, John? I mean, definitely they could have, because he says no to this kind of stuff a lot.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, Denis Villeneuve has gone on record many times saying that he wanted his iteration of Dune to be, or his vision of Dune to be a very Bene Gesserit-focused story, rather than, like, including the Mentats and, you know, all of the other stuff that we get, thankfully, in the book.
Yeah.
But...
They did expect to have Howitt in this one, though. That was the original plan. So it wasn't like... It was just... I mean, he just made a decision, you know, I have to focus more. But then I'm wondering... I don't know. Do you like how often Paul pushes back in this movie before he finally gives in at the end?
I think it's a bit overused.
Especially when you contrast it to how just, like, the book Paul is, like, he's really diving into it. He says yes more often than he says no.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. So, start of this movie, Paul doesn't talk about how, well, he kind of does, but he kind of doesn't talk about how he does, but does not want to use the Missionaria Protectiva to like get at the spice production. So that's him kind of saying, yeah, I'm kind of down with it, but then also not going full Messiah.
Yeah.
And then there's the conversation while Jessica is taking the water of, or immediately after Jessica is taking the water of life of, I'm not your Messiah. And then Jessica's saying to Paul, you need to be a Messiah. And Paul's like, I don't know if I want to be a Messiah. And well, then we have this. So
yeah. I think I have this written down for a future minute, but it's fine to talk about here. Since we've already kind of brought it up, I think Paul's stance on that question has changed since he's been out in the desert, and they're wanting to illustrate that because he was a lot more gung ho about using and manipulating the Fremen when they were in the cafeteria scene earlier in the movie, but now he's very firm, I'm not this, I'm not that. Don't put that label on me.
To quote Gurney from part one, my God, man, you've gone native.
yeah. So I think they're trying to illustrate that the more time he spends with the Fremen, the more he becomes, you know, or he starts to think like them. He starts to, you know, get on their camp and maybe lose track of his original purpose for ingratiating himself in that culture.
And maybe that's why it's important that they made this distinction in the film about Chani being from the north and less given to this, you know, zealotry, because she's holding him in check.
Well, yeah. She doesn't have that thick accent that Stilgar does.
Right. Don't you hear
that? That's how we can tell. I don't have a lot of book notes for this one. We've talked about a lot, but this scene doesn't necessarily happen in the books. We get conversations sort of like this, but we've already talked a little bit about how book Paul and movie Paul are very different in this moment. Book Paul is very assured of himself for the most part, and, you know, going forward with, you know, becoming maybe not necessarily the Messiah in, like, not using that word, but, you know, taking his place as leader of the Fremen. Like, he is very much wanting to do that. Movie Paul has his reservations about it. So some of these themes that we've talked about show up when we have conversations between Jessica and Alia in the book, who's, you know, 2 years old and freaking people out in the South at this point.
I'm going to miss that. I understand, but I'm going to miss it.
I know. I really wanted to see it. We had this really harebrained theory, like, you know, early on in the casting of Dune Part Two, we had Tim Blake Nelson was kind of attached to the movie in some capacity. And we were thinking, it was like, okay, it's either going to be Count Fenring, which, you know, never showed up in the movie, or the only other person that we didn't know who he was playing was young Alia. So I was like, that would be kind of fun to have Tim Blake Nelson as young Alia.
No,
the man's got range. He could do it.
He does.
Oh man.
Oh God.
He was confirmed it was going to be Fenring, right?
I don't know if it was confirmed, but everyone was saying it.
Okay.
Yes, and...
It was. I don't know.
So there was a theory, but then, like, there was something in an interview with Tim Blake Nelson where someone was asking him, like, how did you feel about, you know, your part getting cut from the movie and everything? And he's like, you know, Denis, you know, did what he did in the editing room. I hold no, like, bad feelings or whatever. And then he said something to the extent of, I would love to work with Denis and Josh Brolin again. Which then made me think, okay, maybe he had some scene where Gurney, but so far as I know, Gurney never has any conversation at all with
although he could have rearranged. Yeah, he could have rearranged it for the movie. Yeah.
Who knows?
That would have been excellent casting, Tim Blake Nelson as Fenring. I think that would have been great. So
next World time a miniseries.
Yes.
Do it like sci-fi.
Oh, I love it. I gotta watch that again. It's been a while.
Yeah. Alrighty.
Anything from Art and Soul on this one?
No. Like I said, all of our Art and Soul notes are going to be later for a couple different episodes this week. So we'll talk about those when it's a bit more relevant, I think.
Okay. Cool.
So, Alicia, we have all of the Lorehounds socials, and we have yours as well, but are there any specific projects you're working on that you want to plug for all the people?
I guess most relevant to this is, I'm not sure when exactly this is coming out, but probably on the Woolship Dust feed, we will be in the middle of a deep breakdown of the first book, the original book.
Nice. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
It's kind of crazy that Zach was a Woolship Dust fan before we met you guys and started doing all of this. So
it's a small world of nerds who podcast about their nerdhood.
Yeah, that's right. It sure is. Well, yeah, I always love listening to stuff as I watch or read things. And yeah, I think at the time y'all were the only, maybe still the only Silo series show, like centered show out there. So yeah, of course I found it and loved it ever since.
Apple, call me.
All right, cool. Well, we will be back tomorrow to continue this strange conversation. There's a little bit more of it to get through, and we will get to see exactly what Alia has to say through Jessica on tomorrow's episode of the Dune Minute Podcast. So we will see y'all then.
See you later.
Bye.